So we're here today with Rami Feder. Rami's with Solar Juice for many, many years. He's really an institution solar because you probably start in solar much earlier than many, many others. And to start us and get us the right energy, we have a bit of ritual here. Can you please touch my ball?
Both or just one?
Just that one. Yeah, you see now it gets us the right energy level. To be very frank, you're not striking me as a typical solar guy. You know, you're not walking around in moccasins around Newtown, etc. You're from Granville. You're from the western suburbs. Solar is a bit trendy still. So how the hell did you get into solar?
Well, it started back in high school. I lived in Villawood, and there was a solar plant located in Villawood called SolarX. So back in 94, I think I was in year 10, there was a few other guys that actually worked in the factory. And, yeah, they seemed quite happy there. You know, they were excited that they were working in solar. As I said, I was only, probably 14, 15. And went in for an interview, and the plant manager said, "You're too young. You need to finish your studies. Then I might consider you a role." So, yeah, so fast forward, finished year 12. Got my HSC, picked up the HSC, walked straight to the facility.
The next day?
The next day. I actually met one of the same receptionists there when I first walked in. Her name was Margaret Halsey. And, yeah, I said, "I'm here to see the plant manager. I've got my HSC. I'm ready to work." Had the interview with him and he said, "Okay, I've got a job for you, but it's as a process worker." So I was really keen to get my foot in the door. I continued my studies full-time as well at the same time as an accountant or accounting course, which was really, really tough working night shift in the solar factory and studying during the day with the accountancy course. After 2 years, there was a merger between SolarX and BP Solar. And then when the merger happened, we moved over to Olympic Park. It was the largest solar cell factory in the world.
No, Nigel said so too. It was about 40 to 50 megawatts.
50 megawatts of solar cells. The panel factory was actually quite small. I think it was close to 12 megawatts, probably peaked when I was there. It was because the cells in Sydney that we were manufacturing was also shipped to the other facilities around the world for BP. So we're shipping cells to Spain, US, India, even Saudi Arabia. And that was my role, was to control that. And at the same time, was also sourcing the key raw materials as well.
So basically Australia at that point in time was manufacturing cells, exporting and earning export income from the manufacturing, and your role was to make sure it goes all around the world.
Traditionally, BP was manufacturing the wafers in-house, the solar cells in-house and panels. So this special task force team was put in place when the demand that BP had at the time, BP Solar had, we weren't able to produce in-house. So we had to source these key raw materials externally.
So we're talking what year?
This was probably 2003 when the shortages first started to happen.
So 2003, Australia's boom hasn't started yet. We're really, I think, installing less than 3 to 4 megawatt a year, which is like what a Sydney suburb sometimes installs in a couple of weeks now. And I think Telstra was one of the largest users of solar panels at the time for their mobile network.
Correct.
And it was mainly off-grid that really the panels went to, isn't it, in Australia? I mean, the off-grid market was usually bigger than the residential at that point in time, because what was the price point per watt?
It was anywhere probably close to $5 a watt, US.
Right, right.
USD.
And where are we sitting now?
Under 25 cents USD. Right.
So it's a 40 times reduction. I don't know what that is, 4,000% or something like that. And without that, we wouldn't have a solar boom, would we?
No. Yeah. As you mentioned earlier, the grid connect market was virtually, non-existent.
So there's BP Solar. It's going nicely. You're the biggest supplier in Australia, you're distributing, you've got a dealer network, it's 2006, something like that. And then a couple of years later, suddenly BP Solar decides to pull the plug. How did that, I mean, did you have a feeling that was coming?
Well, I resigned in 2007.
Right.
Actually. And that's when the raw material price was just, peaking. I think it peaked at 2009 at $500 per kilo for polysilicon.
Wow.
Where today, you know, you can pick it up under $20. Identified an opportunity where I could go out on my own. And it was a big risk. Everyone thought I was crazy. I was one of the few guys who ever resigned from BP. Usually people wait, stick around for their redundancy. Somehow I got myself in a position where I was supplying manufacturers out of China. So I wasn't sourcing from China. I was actually supplying all these new facilities. And one of them was even Longji. At one stage, I was the largest supplier.
And where did you get it from in the first place? From other parts in China? Or?
No. So all the stuff that I was sourcing was from Europe and the US. So I would bring it back into Australia, repackage it and re-export it. I was actually air freighting many tons of material. So, the air freight bill was massive. But because the raw material price was just moved so out of control, the margins were quite large. So I was happy to forego some of that with freight. Instead of throwing it on the boat, I wanted to turn it around very, very quick.
Yeah. So if I get this right, at one stage, China was relatively small in solar panels.
Yeah.
They got their material from Europe. You were the middleman and you actually exported to China from Australia material for solar panels.
Correct.
So it's kind of totally on its head now.
China towers over the rest of the countries. One example is solar wafers, 97% come out of China.
So, I mean, I was with Suntech in the early days and that was Dr. Shi, who actually was working in Australia too at the University of New South Wales and then took that knowledge and that research and started the first large factory in China. But that must be the big change that you've seen in the industry because you have been in contact with China literally from day one and you must have a lot of contacts. I know you're traveling all the time and a few days you're off again to China. You have possibly a very unique perspective on the whole China picture because you have been there right from the start with the solar journey. What has changed? How's it all happening?
The trade show, SNEC, S-N-E-C. Mm. I went to the very first one. I think it was back in 2005. Was at a hotel, two levels. Now, I had dinner with one of the actual founder of SNEC. I asked the question, I said, so this year, how many halls do you expect? 26. So 26, these all energy halls that we go to. These Melbourne exhibition halls that we attend and all energy only takes up one or two halls. This is like 20 plus. And these are all massive halls just full of solar companies.
So wow.
That's a good way to see that. Talk about the growth.
Is that because the Chinese government recognized renewables as a industry of the future and very actively pursued that industry and supported it? And now they're really dominating the world because they can supply in the largest number, meaning at the lowest price. Is that what happened?
I've actually witnessed where companies receive the whole infrastructure, like the building, here's your building, do what you want with it. In terms of solar. So they do have advantage in terms of capital costs in setting up a solar facility. And as you mentioned, what helps greatly as well is there's a massive local market in China for solar.
But you would have seen a very different attitude of the very early startups in solar when you would have went there and they were still working out how they can get into Europe and how they can grow their business in Australia to now where the European panel manufacturers are basically just either not around or in such smaller volume that the competition is very, very difficult.
When I first joined SolarX, they were manually tabbing the cells, stringing the cells, where I would put it together, put it in an oven, then cut off the off cuts, all manually. Where now it's all very automatic.
Mm.
And in China, if you visit any of the factories now, it's as high tech as a factory in Korea, a factory in the US, a factory in Germany. If anything, now people are, I mean, I've been to some facilities in the US where the equipment's from China, the manufacturing equipment.
But in the olden days, they used to solder it by hand. So because I remember the rows of mainly women sitting there, long rows and rows and rows, and they're all sitting there all day soldering. And that was the early days of the industry.
Yeah.
And there's nobody who produces still like that, is there?
No. Everyone's moved into robotic machines.
Fully automatic.
Yeah. Companies from Europe and the US, even Australia, could charge a premium because they had a premium product, right? The efficiency was higher. But now it's quite tough where China's leading, in some cases, the race in terms of efficiency, especially with the standard P-type or even the Topcon technology where they're ahead of the curve in terms of efficiency. On the regular P-type and the Topcon, the big Chinese players are winning. And so it's very hard to claim to be a more premium product when in terms of on paper.
The numbers. Of efficiencies, temperature, performance, et cetera, you're actually behind.
Yes.
And that technology, a lot of it was researched here in Australia, wasn't it?
Correct.
So we actually sold that technology, usually from the University of New South Wales, overseas.
Leasing, sold, I'm not quite sure. Yeah. But, I mean, I even posted something on social media recently where I was sort of scratching my head trying to understand, you know, majority of the technology used around the that's being produced at the moment originated from Australia, but nothing's a very small fraction is actually made in Australia. So totally agree on that.
Interesting. So you've seen the journey, the residential solar. When did that actually pick up, and how did you take advantage of that?
I actually received a call from Andrew Burgess in, I think it was around 2008. He said, there's a really good opportunity now in Australia with this, I think it was like an $8,000 rebate. I can't remember. I think it was for 1 kilowatt system. And I was saying, nah, that sounds too difficult. It's a lot easier just shifting, you know, tons of material from one part of the world to the other. Oh, that's too much work. You know, you have to try to sell systems or, because I think at that time Andrew was working for Conergy. But BP was still around. I'm not sure.
Conergy was one of the largest distributors coming from Germany, and they had a distribution business here in Australia, and Andrew was one of their sales guys. Yeah. So he saw distribution. So he knew distribution. You knew sales and procurement. So somehow you could see an opportunity.
Yeah, so he was pushing me to, let's do something together. And I was like, nah, that's too difficult. Then all of a sudden, the supply demand for raw material went the other way, and you know prices where I mentioned earlier they moved to $500 a kilo, crashed. Then at the same time, Andrew was mentioned there's another huge subsidy. I think it was the New South Wales 60-cent feeding tariff. This is a time there's this $8,000 thing happening, and I didn't really understand it back then. And then there's a 60 cent feeding tariff now for New South Wales.
Which basically meant a system payback went from 12 years down to 5 or 6 years. And if you bought the right big system, even maybe down to 4 years if the system was cheap enough. So that was a complete game changer. And that's when the residential solar took off. The person that we have to thank for that, do you actually know who that is?
Maurice Yemmer, I don't know.
No, John Howard.
Oh, really?
John Howard is the solar king. He started the $8,000 rebate to re-secure his re-election, and suddenly solar people were actually very valuable voters.
But in terms of the 60 cent?
That was Joe Tripodi.
Okay.
And they deliberately made it so high because they knew they would lose the election, and they thought, well, the others have to take it off again and get everybody upset. So it was a very political ploy to make it so high, which was really unsustainable because they were already on the nose. They thought we might not win, and then the Liberals have to drag it back down and everybody will hate them for that.
So I reached out to an old school friend, which I ran into, which was Harry Charmy.
Oh, the industry knows Harry.
Yes, I randomly ran into him at a local shop because we still, I grew up in Villawood. I never moved too far away. I was staying in that Western Suburbs area, and Harry was, I think it was at Regent's Park, and he was like, have you heard of carbon footprint? He was talking about carbon neutral. And he was just like, because as you know, Harry, whatever he's into, and he, if he enjoys it, he becomes overly obsessive, right? He's like, oh, you have to get your company carbon neutral. I go, it's only myself. I mean, I said, what do you think about solar? He goes, oh, because it was all about the environment, right? And yeah, he goes, I'm up for that. So I said, look, we could be possibly setting up the company soon. So Harry was actually employee number one. He actually started before Andrew.
Wow.
Right? In terms of hands-on. Once we received the first two containers, it was actually Hyundai panels. After Hyundai, we brought in Silex panels, so which was the only Australian manufacturer at the time, which took over the BP facility. Yeah, so we were the largest distributor for that product. So thankfully for that 60 cent feeding tariff, the market, obviously exploded. We went with that strategy of back then, right? We wanted some sort of quality. So that's why we went with Hyundai. Also, what sort of earned us a bit of credibility at that particular time was it was almost impossible to source SMA inverters. Globally, they were oversold. So I reached out to my European contacts and we managed to get our hands on a lot of SMA. And I spoke to the local office and I said, do you have any issues if I parallel import SMA from Germany? We have no issue with that, but it's impossible. So good luck with that. Next thing you know, I'm bringing in. I'm flying in. I'm chartering planes from Germany. We're basically paying something like $600 per inverter because these were heavy 6 kilowatt transformer inverter. They weighed like at least 70 kilos each. We were airfreighting those, and that's what sort of we caught the eye of many of the installers and helped us. And once they understood our background, they knew we were the real deal. We knew what we were doing. And we quickly, I think that first full year, we turned over, I think it was $60 million.
On a first-year basis for a new business.
For a new business, yeah.
Now, bringing all these big inverters from Europe and parallelly importing the SMAs and bring them all in by air freight, that wouldn't have done much for the carbon footprint of the product. How did you feel about that? You had to do what you had to do, was it?
At that particular time, we wanted to satisfy customer orders. Unfortunately, correct in saying that. When you look at it that way, it wasn't helping.
I noticed also at that time a lot of people brought whole containers from China indirect. So there was a 25-year warranty given, but you really didn't know who you go to for that warranty. Did you had to compete with those guys?
Yes, but I think where the pain was first felt was inverters. I think that's why today we see people are not so price conscious when it comes to inverters. Right now, I mean, and it's been the case for many years now, at least the last 6 years, Fronius has been the most expensive inverter, the biggest selling Chinese inverter, and actually the biggest selling inverter in Australia last year was Sungrow. And that's by far the most expensive inverter out of China. Versus the majority of the other China brands, it's close to probably 50% more expensive. But because of the quality of that product, because of the local after-service support, like Fronius as well, like SMA, Sungrow is still selling in volume because of those lessons learned in the early days.
In the early years, was there ever a bit of a disaster with inverters or panels where there was quality issues?
We copped it firsthand, right? Because of that shortage, we were forced to look at inverters, unknown inverters out of China and Taiwan. A lot of these companies were unknown, so we're trying to deal with companies who were diversified. So Powercom had a similar routes where it was a large UPS publicly listed company in Taiwan. And there were, their model was more OEMing inverters for other companies. So we thought it was a proven inverter at that time. So in terms of warranty, they didn't provide any replacements. They only provided parts. On top of that, the failure rate was actually over 100%. We replaced it and then it failed again. So we had some existing units that we had in stock. So when there was a failure, we didn't have any in-house after-service team. Powercom didn't have any presence, unfortunately. I mean, our focus is always the customer and we wanted to keep them happy. So we provided another Powercom, failed. Another Powercom, failed. So we started replacing them with Samil. With Samil, I believe...
That's another Chinese brand, yeah, isn't it? Yeah.
They were doing really well. But I believe they changed their way in terms of after service. I brought in a European team and I just think it just imploded. They tried to bring in those processes and for whatever reason, it just done a 180 and we quickly moved away from it. But the failure rate for Samil, we didn't have any sort of comparison versus your Powercoms, your K-Stars.
And how soon when they were installed did they actually suddenly fail?
This is where I'll go back to when I heard third-party stories. I was told with some of these brands, I think they're like JFY and
AeroSharp and all those. Sunnyroo.
KLNE.
They're all gone.
People will take,
they're all gone.
People will take three inverters to a job site.
Just
in case. And their intention was to install one inverter. They'll take three because there's a good chance that one will be dead on arrival, right? So they didn't even fire up.
I heard one of the suppliers, if you ordered 100, you always got a box, you got 120 on the pallet because there was a given failure rate in the brand new product. These were cowboy days.
It was because back then there wasn't a local office, right? So to give you confidence, they'll say, oh, if you have any warranty issues, you can do we've provided some additional units. But yeah, we took a massive hit. And that's why today we've evolved on purely just high-end quality products, especially on the inverter side. It's nothing but, I mean, the cheapest inverter we have is Sungrow. And as I mentioned earlier, that's the most expensive Chinese inverter. So we carry Sungrow, we carry Enphase, Fronius, SMA. All these brands are definitely on the high-end side. With panels, that's a whole different ball game where it's come to a point where in Australia, brand loyalty is not that important anymore on the China side. To be the big, you could say the big five. I think everyone considers them very similar. So your JAs, your Longji, your Trina, your Jinkos, and to a degree maybe Canadian. It's whoever provides the better price in that particular watt class because a lot of them almost have identical looking panels.
Sometimes made even in the similar factory and just get a different sticker on the back? Does that still happen?
Prior to COVID, so when a brand's very popular, that's when it's more likely that it's probably made. There's a chance for it, not that it's made, but there's a chance that they are probably from a factory that's not from their own in-house factory. Because what they do, how it works is once the demand consumes whatever capacity they have, they look at the other factories which are not so busy, who are not so strong on sales and marketing, and I've seen in my own eyes where I've gone to manufacturer A and I see them producing manufacturer B, which is a popular branded product.
Right.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, they are honoring their warranties. But technically, based on the CEC, they're supposed to be using, the factory that's tied into the TUV's certification.
But the CC is not necessarily in China. I mean,
it's impossible to track. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to track.
Now, with the company, it's growing. You're getting new staff. You're setting up in Wetherill Park. Was there a particular product other than those PowerCore inverters, let's say in the panel range, where you guys took a big bath? Because actually, you got a product in, it didn't do what it's promised, but you as a company stood behind the product and built it up and actually didn't let your customer down?
Yeah, there's an example with bankruptcies, right? Or they've exited Australia. We have had that. That's where we've taken a hit. We'd have to pay the labour. We'll have to provide the replacement panels. So we've done that in the past.
I want to go back to China because there is possibly, how many times have you in your whole career now in solar traveled back to China?
I was attending probably minimum every 2 months.
Right. And so you've been doing this 15 years or so. That's more than 100 times you've gone back to China for relationship building, for purchasing product. Go back to the very early days to right now. Is there different confidence? Is there different China? Is there a different relationship in Australia? What are the changes? There's nobody better than you to observe that when you've traveled 100 times to the country. And I actually, my personal opinion is the reason why we haven't had inflation in the last 20 years is because China has been able to produce product that got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and put anti-inflationary pressure on our economy, which has helped us all. Right? That is at the moment not recognized when America is all pissed off that they're sitting on their asses and China is not sitting on their asses and America has shown up. You must have seen a sophistication and a professionalism coming through over the last 10 years. Just give me the journey.
Especially in the new facilities, you're blown away. You're talking about huge machinery and it's a massive infrastructure, newly built, the latest state-of-the-art equipment. I'm always just blown away by the sheer size and the tech used. China is just leading the pack at the moment. You know, you look at, as I said to you earlier, you look at the data sheets, the spec sheets, they're head and shoulders now above Europe and US made product.
Right, right.
In terms of, as I said, purely just the numbers, they're definitely leading the way.
Did you make any friendships or is it always just professional?
The part I play in the supply chain, it's all built on relationships. Look, it's all, of course, business related, but some friendships have been built as well. But to be honest, their staff turnover is quite high, right? A lot of the middle management do hop over to different companies. Even some of the founders, you know, leave and set up new companies. What's more important for me is the brand relationship on the high level in terms of solar juice with, for example, Trina, or solar juice with Sungrow, solar juice with Fronius.
Mm.
I feel that no matter who the management is, there's always a good relationship with those key partners. And unfortunately, in terms of dealing with companies out of China, they still don't understand channel. All they know is numbers. Where the very few, which Trina has probably, in my opinion, probably the best channel control, where it makes sense for us, you could say, I want to say best channel control, but where the channel makes sense for solar juice, there is margin there. Instead of selling into channels where they bring in new markets or identify new customers, they just sell to, if somebody comes up to them and says, I'm happy to buy 100 megawatts, they ignore their strategy and just go after the number. Everyone wants 20% market share, unfortunately. And what that means is they basically force feed their distributors and beyond what they can take, which causes an oversupply, or they balloon their local warehouses, which we've seen over the last few years happen many times, which causes a local panel price to collapse. Even some of these new big players, right? They're talking a couple of hundred megawatts. I'm thinking, you weren't existent in Australia last year. How do you expect to achieve those sort of numbers? So that they look at what the other person's doing and they try to duplicate or reach higher number to brag, not bragging rights, but if they can achieve that, we can also achieve that. That's the biggest challenge I'm facing.
So you then have to actually be educating them and sometimes say that's a little bit ambitious, and you have to do that rather tactfully.
Unfortunately, the local team members, they agree, but it's HQ they're struggling with. And they say, no, you have to achieve this number.
We need renewables. Hasn't the world in some way put themselves in a huge dependency on China now, while at the same time geopolitically China at the moment and the West are not talking as well as even 10 years ago? How does that all going to fit in, that dependency? What about if China decides one day we don't want to supply you?
We're in trouble. Especially, a panel factory doesn't take long to build. Whether you're going to get it to the cost level as China is a whole different ballgame. The next level up where wafers and especially polysilicon, you're talking about even if you had the money and you can make sense, you can justify somehow on turning over a profit, it will take at least, especially in the West, at least 3 years to build a sizable polysilicon plant. It doesn't happen overnight. So, yeah, if we wanted to become totally independent, it won't happen overnight. It's going to take at least a few years. In terms of wafers, I'm hearing there is some plants being built in the US. India have big plans as well on the solar wafer front. I've spoken to some of the larger players there. On the panel level, they have massive capacity. Cell capacity also ramping. So there is options there, but my guess is they'll want to satisfy the local market before looking elsewhere.
You've survived it all the way. What's your biggest advice to an end customer right now if they want to buy solar? From your 15 years of experience, what should they do?
Definitely look at quality first, then look at the price. If you use pricing as your sole objective, you'll be burnt. Me personally is after service support. You know, do they have an office in Australia? Do they have a large after service support team? The track record. And I'm pretty sure looking at reviews, that should disclose whether or not they've been a good good product or good operator in Australia.
What are the biggest challenges right now in solar?
On a distributor front, we've got so many variables, right? Put aside the regular supply chain, you know, oversupply, undersupply, local market, you know, demand dying out, or all of a sudden there's a massive surge. But we have things like FX. You saw the dollar just move from, you know, less than 2 weeks ago it was above 71. Last week it hit 65 cents. So with distribution, our margins are very thin. What keeps us in business is our volume. If our volume wasn't, if we can't keep volume at a certain level, if that also drops, that could also put us out of business. So, yeah, as I said earlier, it's not just the solar coaster, it's also the FX coaster as well.
How do you pick product, what's going to be the right product for the next season and how much you need? I mean, how do you pick that?
As you know, with inverters, there's so many different variables, right? There's so many different models. So for us, we don't like to carry more than three or four different brands. And if you look at, you know, what we carried back in 2015, majority of the inverters we had back then, we still have, like your SMA, your Fronius. This year with panels, we're basically running just three brands, right? REC, which is a non-Chinese brand option, and we have Trina.
But did you previously, when you picked partners, were allowed into their factories?
A lot of the time they don't, but I not bully myself in, but I'm able to convince them that I need to see it.
Right.
In most cases, if not all cases, I get my foot in the door onto the factory floor. Even though we're very comfortable with the brands that we're dealing with, it's probably just a extra insurance that they are using the correct raw material versus what was specified on the TUV certification.
Now, you having been originally in a factory, starting on the factory floor and seeing all the processes, so when you walk into a factory, can you within a very short time straight away tell if that place is focused on quality or if there are a few issues?
Let me just share a story where I won't name the company, but this company was huge, right? Just because the company has a well-known, recognized brand, and it just isn't their OEM factory. This is their own branded factory. So right away, without any hesitation, there was a big X in continuing using that company because we were bringing in that particular brand in. So I visited the factory because the original factory they had was okay. So they were bragging about, oh, we've expanded, it's fully automatic, blah, 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 blah. Walk in, they've got windows open in the factory. So
the dust comes in onto the panels.
So then I was questioning, because I brought in my internal QC guy. We were questioning the processes they have. So with me seeing the windows open, so I questioned about foreign material. So what if foreign material was encapsulated in the solar panel? Oh, we've got these are the parameters. And they allowed something like a 20-cent piece coin size foreign material as
being acceptable.
Yeah.
A couple of bugs, what's wrong with that?
So right away we just stormed out of them. Basically, the QC technical guy, because he was speaking to him in Chinese, he stormed out because he couldn't believe his ears. And when he told me, I tried to speak to somebody who spoke English, which there was. Can we reduce this? He said, no. I said, okay, then we're ripping up the contract. So from that day forward, we stopped bringing in that particular type of panel. You won't see it unless you actually visit it physically, because all their PowerPoint presentations, videos they show you, there's a massive variable versus when you actually visit the factory.
Now, from an environmental point of view, are there some manufacturers from their waste disposal and all that treat things differently to others? And do you guys go that deep into who you're supplying, or you're really kind of just worried about the manufacturing process and the labor sourcing, the raw material sourcing, the waste and all that? Is that part of your whole spectrum when you pick a manufacturer, or you're just looking at price?
Some of those concerns that you raise have only come about very recently. But in terms of environmental, I'm pretty confident that with the ones we're using or above board, because they are public companies.
Mm.
I mean, a lot of them were listed on the US, like Trina, where they were under the microscope for those particular, especially environmental issues. I mean, one of them was pulled up, not the ones we were using, but one of the big five were pulled up probably back in 2012. I mean, you can Google it.
Mm.
And they've obviously rectified those issues, and I'm pretty sure nobody else would take that similar risk of being exposed, because it is very embarrassing.
One with the fish who died down the bottom of the ocean? I'm not talking the manufacturer, but I'm just saying kind of pollution.
It was a river. Mm, yeah, mm, yeah.
Mm. What about the whole panel recycling game? Is that picking up?
If a panel is produced properly, it should last 20 plus years. What I'm trying to say is, if they're not, these recycling plants aren't put in place today or next year or the year after, I don't see it as a big risk. But we do need something probably in the next 5 to 10 years, because there is lots of precious materials that can be recovered. So I'm pretty sure someone can make a business case out of that particular segment.
What about the idea to ask manufacturers to put a $3 levy on each panel to then use that to subsidize the transport and all that of panels? I don't know how that would affect distributors, but have you heard of proposals like that at all?
People claiming this 25-year product warranty, there should be a certain percentage of money should be put in escrow. So if a company does go out of business,
Or leaves Australia,
there's some escrow money there where, whether it's a distributor or the importer, should be putting aside that money for when there is a warranty issue in the years to come, as you said, if they're exited, which we've seen it happen many, many times.
Mm.
And that would basically create a barrier to entry into Australia, which will ensure that there is a quality product. So I'm pretty sure any company where if they have to put their
reputation on the block, then yeah. Maybe
or some have some skin in the game where where at least there has to be some sort of pool of money there. At least there should be a pool there for at least 5 years.
Got it. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. And that would have to be pushed through from the federal government, really, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because 25 years, why is it only, and it, with inverters now, it's industry standard for 10 years, right? Your TV has a one-year warranty, two-year warranty. Years, yes. What about your, even something like a fridge, how many years does that have? Why is it something that's mounted externally?
I mean, you imagine, did any manufacturer would go back from 25-year warranty to 10?
But the issue is if they disappear, then it falls on the distributor or the importer. And if they disappear, it falls onto the
installer.
So just creates this chain where eventually once there is a problem, you know.
A lot of innocent people will be hurt.
And it'll be, unfortunately, it'll be the, my guess is it'll be the Australian businesses or you know, Australian jobs which should be put at risk because a company that's where they're supposed to have the obligation have ran away.
I have a saying which is the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I think it's our consumer law that actually causes relative innocent companies to then go bust because I think the consumer law says if the importer goes to you or if you're the distributor and the importer, then that's the distributor first if the manufacturer has left.
We're deemed as a manufacturer. Then, once you import.
Yeah, then the next level, if you decide, oh, we can't support 2 million panels, then it goes to the installer. And if the installer says, well, there's...
And when you say installer, it's installers, right?
Yeah.
Because there'll be many.
Many. Yeah, yeah. But somebody could have easily installed 20,000 panels of a certain brand over a period, and if they have an issue, then that business will go too. I mean, I think the number in Australia now of businesses who've left the solar industry because they couldn't handle the warranty issues coming back to them innocently is over 800. So, but the consumer law in the first place wanted to protect the consumer, but in some way, if you have manufacturers who do not play the game, it goes actually back to the poor people who trusted that product, and eventually the loss could also be with the end customer because if nobody's there left, then the end customer can't get any remedy on that warranty. So exactly. There's a big difference between one warranty between one reputable manufacturer and the warranty for somebody else who just looks reputable on paper. But as soon as there's stuff happening, they pull back.
And as you said, when they can't get the customer over the line, oh, let's just increase the warranty.
That's true too, yes.
Unfortunately. Yes.
To be in solar, you've got to be a hard worker. You can't go to solar if you want to bludge because you'll be on a roof, you're on hot weather, you're inside roofs in hot weather. If you don't want to work, don't go into solar. So how do you build the relationship with those people and how do you win the trust?
I just tell it as it is, right? Whatever, if I don't understand something, if they've got a question, I can't answer it, I'll say I can't answer it. But if they do ask a question and I do have an answer, I'll just give an unfiltered opinion. The main questions I get is, what do you think of this particular product or brand? Even if I don't carry that particular product, I'll just give my honest feedback on it.
Now, being a distributor that is focusing a little bit more on the quality gear and you're not taking every year a different new product, you must see a lot of manufacturers walking into your door trying to, because you're doing big volume, trying to win you over. And often you must say things like, well, sorry, we're not taking you. How's that goes down?
Sorry, we're full. if it's, look, for not just for sologists, right, just to enter the Australian market is so tough. Whether it's a panel, inverter, battery, it's easy to enter Australia, but to actually sell, if you're not a proven product or proven brand, is super difficult. I think the installer really dictates what the consumer wants. Okay, the consumer might be researching, but I think their interaction with the installer or the sales consultant is what sort of
determines what's on the roof.
Exactly. Yeah, and because of, especially the guys, the installers and the sales consultants who have been around more than a few years would quickly learn to only offer proven products. Even though it probably will probably be the most affected if they removed the government subsidy for panels and placed it on the battery instead, purely just solar panel system sales will go down, but the battery plus solar will definitely increase. But naturally, when you have a battery, it just means the good thing about that is it definitely drives more panels to be on that particular roof. Where someone with just solar, you see out there all these, you see just with the promotions, right? It's all 6.6. When a battery comes into play, if the sales consultant does his job correctly, or the person that's selling the system will be trying to cover as much roof space as possible to get the most out of the battery.
Mm. So how do you see the EV coming into that? So there's the panel, there's the battery, and then there's the EV as well.
I mean, at home we have two EVs, and definitely it has a massive impact on the electricity charge consumption.
So you're supplying your EVs with solar or not?
Yeah, I have a 12 kilowatt on the roof, and also I have a massive battery as well. That's because I like to practice what I preach. With EV owners looking at the electricity bill, seeing it all of a sudden increase. Yes, they're saving versus
petrol.
But they could be saving a lot more if the EV is being charged by solar.
Right. So maybe down the track, if you're a car dealer, you sell an EV and a solar system.
That's what Tesla are doing.
not done, but there's a problem with the Tesla issue I see, whereby, for example, the Nissan Leaf, you can integrate into the house, at least theoretically. I think there's still bureaucratic kind of hurdles. But from Tesla's perspective, they want to see the car not really plugged in the back of the house because they've got the battery to sell the battery separately. So there are different, you know, there's the Apple model where you want to be all within your own infrastructure, and there are other models that click on and click out, and we both will not know which one will win out in the end. But can you see the day where the EV drives into the house and actually becomes the battery for the house?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of talk about that, but have to actually see it happen in the real world, I mean, would you want to start your car and you got no juice left because it's powering your home? So when I visited Tesla a few years back prior to COVID, that was one of the questions is, do you guys have any plans to move to bi-directional? And the answer was no, because they did give that example. And I thought about it and I believe they're right. I know that people might say they're driven by selling more power walls, but I believe, if you're the last thing I want is to be driving a car that's at 25% capacity or less.
Because your kids played rock and roll all night.
Or you've got your ducted on at night.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, in the summer days. Mm. Yeah.
Finishing off, what's your prediction for the next couple of years? The industry's still gonna grow, or everybody's got solar on the house and that's the end of it?
Another case where EVs do have an impact would be obviously with production ramping up, which means battery production ramping up, which means pricing should naturally, with scalability, pricing is supposed to come down as long as raw material pricing doesn't go up. That would help stationary storage pricing to become more competitive and better return on investment. So once we reach that sweet spot where it does make sense, or the payback is well within the warranty period, naturally, as I said before, when you put batteries on your home, it just naturally will equal larger solar systems.
Mm. But there are people who've got a 3 or 4 kilowatt there who expect to put a battery on the back, and the sales guy has to really pop their bubble and say, listen, you need a new system and a bigger system. Is that happening a lot?
I would think that will happen. I mean, it's not good, right, to rip off an existing system, but I feel that many homeowners like the look of their home, and I think it will look quite ugly with different size panels on your roof, unless you're able to place the different size panels on a different pitch side of the roof. On the same side, I believe, if that's the only side they could use, I think most likely they will rip it off, even though I don't agree with that way.
And start from fresh, start fresh.
But again, then you got the landfill issue.
What type of installer does really SolarJuice seek as their key customer?
For us, it's more, we try to build a relationship, loyalty, where when I say loyalty, we're loyal to them, not just them being loyal to us. Quality driven installers, where they're not just talking price, they ask the hard questions about the different, you know, parameters of a particular product. They ask questions around what's the after service like as well.
They pay their bills.
That's very important.
Because you have been in solar for so long and you have seen all the ups and downs and in the middle had to always hold on and stay on top of it. So it's a very interesting journey. I enjoyed it immensely. I really appreciate you shared it today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Want more energy answered? Visit yourenergyanswers.com for quality energy products, tools and calculators, and find your quality local installers. Please support the channel by liking the video, hit that subscribe button, and ring the bell, and check out all our other videos. You're still here? I'll see you next time. Bye.